Hello, sad news today. Mr. Brian Doherty passed away on June 5th with complications from cancer. And it seemed ironically enough that I just found about it this morning, and I was just doing a charity ride for cancer on a bicycle. So it's a sad day. It's a sad day, and this is becoming, unfortunately, a part of this podcast where we have to honor the people who have passed away. And this is something I think we need to do. It's something that people have told me in the past that it helps hearing the person's voice, and it helps with their healing. And so this is my, I guess, tribute to Brian Doherty and his love of music, his love of the guitar, and his love of just being in a band and being just a normal person in today's wacky world. Yeah, let's just say rest in peace, Brian, and I hope you find more happiness wherever that might be. Rest easy, sir. Big Reg did Edgefest, right?
I think that's probably where I met you. If anything would have been on Edgefest, that crazy tour, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. You had Eric Blakely as your guitar tech on that tour.
Yes, correct.
And there was a special night in Calgary where he drove a golf cart into the side of a tour bus. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, you remember that? Yeah, I think some of the stuff that was going on in our camp was a bit of a highlight of the tour. Stuff like that. Yeah, he was turning, looking at somebody. I think it was me. I don't remember. And half in the bag, like everybody else, and somebody said something, and he said, all right, well, I'm going to go then, and he pressed the gas, and he just drove. The bus was like, or whatever, he drove, and was it a bus?
Yeah.
It was a bus, yeah, whatever it was right here, and he just turned and went forward, and it was, because he didn't realize it was there.
I think two days later, yeah. I think it was Jeremy from Our Lady Peace, and somebody from some band, they flipped one in Edmonton. A golf cart and got almost thrown in jail. That was that same tour. And and that was the time when people were stealing golf carts, and the production manager was this guy named Tex, and he is now, or was, maybe still is, down at the amphitheater as the production manager. And he's an angry, crotchety man. But we didn't make his life any easier by stealing all his golf carts and driving him into sides of buses. That was it was a fun tour, though.
Something memorable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. That was cool. That was our first. Yeah, that was our first big kind of festival thing. It was neat to wake up in the morning and see 30 buses in front of you going up through the Rockies. And half the time you didn't even know it was on your own bus, right? It's like you wake up and people from other bands and crews would be lying in your front lounge, passed out naked.
Yeah,
it was pretty cool. It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, because there was this your sort of first record really, really blew up, didn't it? Like, it really hit hard, and people were all about it, and it sounded amazing, and it was obviously played well. And did you work with Matt DiMatteo on that album?
He engineered that little place, Presence, in Toronto.
That
great sounding little room. That Zoll tape, Neve console.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know, it was great. We did a 24-track Neve console and taped the whole thing. Did it in like 9 days there. And then, once we got signed with it, we were off to LA to mix it with Puig. But that was a great little room.
Yeah. Yeah, and Matt is a great, great engineer, great sound guy, and he worked with other bands. I think he worked with Rusty too. I think he did one of their albums.
Yeah. And Wardman. Wardman was the producer, so that was the same team that did our first record, did the Rusty stuff.
I think
that was actually before. It was right before us, actually. Before our first record was done, they did the Rusty.
It was the first Rusty with like Groovy Dead and all that stuff, like. But I gotta say, that sounds great. But your album, to me, it was. I guess going to LA and mixing it made a big difference on the overall outcome, right?
I don't know. To be honest with you, I think right out of the gate, it was like we did it there in 9 days. I think we could have mixed it and had really good result. I think once we got involved in the big record company thing, it was. the big massive budget, and you got to go out to LA and do it with a big name and all that kind of thing, which is great too. I mean, you know, weed, right? But
yeah,
you know.
Were you originally, when did you join Big Wreck? Like, when did all this come together? Like, the early beginnings, you've obviously played in bands your whole life because you're a guitar player and, you know, and when did you start getting into bands? Actually, that's a better question. Like, when were you really into bands and stuff?
Probably late teens. I studied music. Like, I studied trumpet classical really seriously until I was in my mid-teens, and I got an injury up in here that was permanent, and I kind of stopped playing, but I kind of goofed around with bass and guitar on and off till about the same time when I quit playing trumpet. And then I started playing guitar more seriously and jammed with guys in high school, that kind of stuff. And then after high school, before I went to school, before I went away to college, I played, you know, I had my full-time job and played with some local guys, and we did some recording and demoing, did some shows and stuff. Mm-hmm. Nothing too much came of it. But then I decided that I really wanted to pursue it a bit more and get better at it. So I went to Berkeley, and I actually took some lessons with John Petrucci, who was from a town over, two towns over from me on Long Island in New York. And he gave me a couple of things to get started on before I went, to help me kind of get in. Mm-hmm. And then my second semester at Berkeley, I met Ian. And we hung out a lot together and spent a lot of time at night just listening to music and hanging out. It was really cool. And then the second year, we moved in. We lived in an apartment together, and blah, blah, blah. Things kind of went from there.
So yeah. You're originally from the New York then?
Yeah. Actually, the original bass player was a good friend of mine from, we hung out together, both from Huntington, Long Island. Mm-hmm. And Forrest, the drummer, the original drummer, is from Boston. So all three of us was actually three of us from the States. Ian was the only one from Canada, from Toronto.
It's funny how people penned Big Wreck as the Canadian band when, yeah, like three quarters of it was from from the States.
Yeah, but really at the end of the day, it's Ian's thing more than anybody else. I mean, you know, he's the principal guy there. So
sure.
So consider, you know, just because we hooked up there, right? We lived in Framingham. We lived in Framingham, like at Forest Place. They built a little studio in his apartment there, and we lived there for like a year and blah, blah, blah. We bounced around, mm-hmm. went through hell, and we lived in the crappy apartments with the roaches crawling on you, you know, not eating much, just trying to play and write and record and move on. So,
yeah,
but it was most fun. We ended up basing out of Toronto. So,
and what brought you to Toronto? Was it the fact that Ian was there, or do you always sort of, is that what sort of made the band move there?
Yeah, well, Ian was there, and there was interest in the demos and in some of the material and in the band. So we moved there, and then we lived, and I guess that's when we would have signed or got involved with the management company, management trust at the time, which was Bernie Green, Jake Gold, Alan Gregg. Mm-hmm. And they kind of got us started, putting us out on little tours with like the Watchmen and stuff like that. So we at that time, right, we based everything out of Toronto. We lived in a little crappy place on Dundas and Bellwoods, which is over a fish market. It was horrible. So
it's an interesting concept to know that, you know, you do kind of suffer for your art, and when you suffer for your art, the payback is much greater when you get a little ahead, or you get some a little ahead in life, you know, or with your music, and right?
Yeah. When you get into it and you've read the books and you've heard all the stories about how rock bands go through this and they go through that before they get signed, it's different when you experience it, you know, like we were sleeping over a fish market in the summer that just constantly stunk, and like when you were sleeping or roaches crawling on you and mice running around and rats and stuff. And we didn't have a dime. I mean, seriously, we didn't eat for days.
Really?
We had a couple of Ian's buddies every once in a while would stop by and like drop off food. You know, we didn't really have anything. It was a horrible experience. But you know,
and
living together and going through that stuff gives you strength, I guess, for as you get bigger, right?
Yeah. When you got all this interest and the momentum built quite fast, and a lot of people were interested in Big Rec for, you know, and it happened. And there was like, there's somebody just saw somewhere where the music was going and said, this is where we need to go. Tastemakers, so to speak, you know, picked up on your band. What was sort of the attribute to that? Like, because everything sort of has a reason, right? Like, Pearl Jam was a result of Nirvana, or Nirvana was a result of Pearl Jam, or Guns N' Roses. Everybody hated Guns N' Roses, so they went through Nirvana. Like, what was your early, what sort of got you in the door with influences and things? Like, what was it explained to you? Like, you're the next this or whatever.
I think a lot of the bands at the time, that period of the 90s, like for us, it would have been 97, right? Mm-hmm. When that thing really started to go. I think a lot of the bands that were out there, the Soundgardens, the Pearl Jams, the bands that you're mentioning, mm-hmm. were influenced by a lot of the things that we were influenced from. You know, we listened to the Zeppelin and Floyd and Neil Young and all that. So all the 70s stuff, which was what all those guys were copying, right?
Yeah.
Even, you know, Black Sabbath and all that stuff. You look at the influence of that on, you know, Soundgarden or whatever, right?
Yeah.
I think we were all coming from the same place. We were all ripping off the same people, you know? I think it had a bit of a different, it just had a bit of a different tinge to it, you know? And I think there was a magic inside the band. I think that those four guys at the time playing together was something that nobody else was really doing. There was a, I think it was a bit, it had a schooled edge to it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it felt right. You know, that's a big thing about music, is if it feels right, that sort of goes through any sort of marketing campaign or any sort of styling. It feels right. So when it feels right, a lot of people jump on it for that very reason, you know?
Yeah. No, it felt, I mean, what we were doing, it felt right to us. It wasn't, you know, there was no real thought process. Mm-hmm. We just did what we did, you know. Mm-hmm. There was no mathematical formula for it. It was natural. It was genuine.
Yeah. Well, everything like that happens by accident. You know, it's funny to say there's some people try to engineer the fate of a band or of their career, and sometimes it works. But it all depends on the people who go to the record store, buy the albums. It really depends on those people to pick up on it. Like, you can be exposed. Like, when you do an Edgefest and that's your first real tour, you're playing in front of 20, 30,000 people a day, you know, and that's huge exposure. But it's still up to you to wow these people. You know, I think Matt Good was on that tour too, you know, and that was his first real big tour.
Yeah, everybody was on that, right?
Yeah, that was neat.
Yeah, I think that all the time build up to doing stuff like that is where you walk on stage to perform it. It was no different. It wasn't too much different than if we were playing together in a tiny little club together, you know. We were unintentionally trying to sell something. We just loved doing what we were doing.
Yeah.
And we loved playing. We loved playing the music we were playing.
Yeah.
I think that comes across, you know. People get it.
Yeah, I remember that first single and going, why does this sound so great? You know what I mean? It was so explosive and it was so dynamic for how a chorus came in. You know, it was influential to me as a person that records bands. Go, it really needs, you know, it doesn't matter what genre of music, it just needs that. Those choruses just went bam. And it was huge. It was a huge record, you know, for me, sound wise.
Yeah.
To be able to make a record and have people love it, and then to go on Edgefest, and then to feel that you're getting something back from it, it must feel like a this huge amount of success, you know, like this, whether or not like you're going to make it or not, you know, you're like, well, we're on our way, you know, because you were on your way at that point, you know, and
yeah, the buses didn't matter and the money, you know, while we weren't really making money yet, but anyway, that's the reward, is when you feel that back from the audience and they're enjoying it as much as they enjoy listening to it as much as you enjoy playing it. You know?
Yeah.
If you can make that connection, that's probably the ultimate reward, right?
That's right. And there was, like you say, there was no, There's no engineered plan for that to happen. People just liked it. Yeah. And, you know, there's a right place and a right time for everything, you know, and that was definitely that time. And a lot of bands that I knew too were, you know, that's, I think, 97. What was Treble Charger doing? They weren't doing much of anything. I think they were just opening for the Foo Fighters or whatever on one tour. But it didn't really explode until, like, they almost didn't. Then they it's funny, they made this huge album, the American Psycho album, and then got dropped on A&M Records. And then became the most successful they've ever been in Canada. And did you guys went to the States a lot, huh?
Yeah, we spent most of our time was in the States. We did some pretty brutal runs down there. It was, you know, or 6 months at a time kind of thing, van and trailer.
Yeah.
Maybe two parks and you know the deal. You've done those runs, you know. Go up and down the Midwest, right? Ohio to Texas, all over, right? And then,
yeah.
And do your eastern seaboard constantly. You know, you can do that, go up and down there 4 or 5 times, and then take a couple of weeks off and then cross Canada again. And we did that for, you know, 2 years or 2.5 years.
Yeah, that was the same thing a couple of years later. Like in 2001, I was with Sum 41 as their sound guy tour manager. And we literally did an infinity sign in the United States. Just figure eight. It was a lot, you know. It was a year and a half, and they didn't even break until, you know, their next album. But there was, that's a lot. It's really hard to explain that to people. Like, although they were on a major record label, and you were on a larger record label too, the work you got to put into it, and then you get into a tour bus, or you know, and then you realize, oh my god, I got to work 10 times harder because I got to pay for this tour bus. You know, a lot of people prefer to stay in the van and tour, but you just can't. I mean, you break, your body breaks. You know, you can't just be that guy on tour in the van.
Yeah, and that's for everybody. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's especially crew. You know, for them to be able to, you know, pack up and close up shop at 2 o'clock in the morning, and not have to sit in the van for 4 hours to sleep in a Motel 8 for 2 hours, and then head to load in the next day.
Oh yeah.
It's really cool, you know what I mean? Everybody's so much healthier at that point, so to me, it's worth the cash.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that initial year and a half for you guys, I know what that's like. It's, you're playing everywhere. But you, all that time, you built your base, so when you got the next record out, you've got a great foundation to stand on, right?
Right, right. Yeah, and the United States is where all the money is, unfortunately, for that, for an industry. I don't know. Yeah. What do you think it is like now with Canadian music industry versus American music industry? I mean, we have Canadian content still, but I don't think it really does anything anymore. I think that we're just as strong up here now. We're a global community as opposed to what it was like 20 years ago. It was like, well, you got to make it in the States. If you don't make it in the States, you're never going to make it in Canada, you know, even though from Canada.
Yeah, you know, we've had this conversation a couple of times. I'm still... Some of it I'm curious about. I don't know the industry too well.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do see from Canada is, you know, you take your Mac Goods and your, you know, all the bands that we know, a lot of them just put out your record, you do your cross Canada thing, and then you go over to Europe for months.
Mm-hmm.
You come back, you take a little break, and then you do that cycle again, and they're all doing pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, they're making a living doing that, and they're not really crossing into the States so much, you know? I think that's the key.
Yeah.
I think, like, if you want to just stick, like, keep it easy and not have to deal with the brutality of the States, just because the market's so competitive,
mm-hmm.
you've got to get that European fan base. Do you agree with that?
The other thing, too, is to travel into the States, it costs tens of thousands of dollars for an independent band to go play a shithole in Cleveland. It's not worth it. You know, you can go play a shithole in Italy. No offense to my Italian friends, but you can go there, and they welcome you with open arms. In fact, they give you cheaper places to stay. You know, like... The gas isn't cheap. Gas is super expensive. I never figured that out. Well, like, you're closer to the Middle East than us, yet your gas is twice the price. The fact that you can go to Europe and people appreciate you as a musician more than you would in the States. In the States, you're just like, impress me, Canadian. And they have this stigma against, although you're not Canadian, you're a de facto Canadian. You're now, you know what I mean? Like, but when you go, Americans have this funny look at Canadians. They say like, oh, you silly Russians, you left-wing weirdos with your healthcare and your Canadian content rules. And they have weird look to them.
I don't think that that was really our experience. I think there was a draw to our bands from a musician's standpoint. Like, we built our following around that. I don't know if anybody really cared if we were Canadian. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm talking from a fan perspective.
Sure.
Right. Maybe not so much from a business perspective. But I think if you've got something cool to sell, and you need the cash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's going to put up, $100,000 to go tour in the States for a month, right?
No.
Right? That's a lot of fun. But it is. I mean, if you brought up, going back to the beginning of this part of the conversation, we talked about the Europe thing and how you go over there and people it's totally different. Mm-hmm. It's not about product. They just appreciate music, mm-hmm. which is something we always wanted to experience. And I never could figure out, and I was never really told why we never did that. Like, why didn't we ever build a base in Europe? Why didn't we get the hell out and do it a long time ago? And this year was the first year we went. We went to Germany for just like a week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, those tiny little rooms, you play like 100 or 200 seat rooms, but everybody just, they're watching everything you do, and they're listening to all the parts. You know, they're really, that's cool. Like, I could stay there and play music forever. I love that. I don't care where we play, right?
Yeah.
But, no one's talking while they're listening. You know, everybody's just very attentive, and it's cool. I love it.
I'm so glad you got to experience that. You know, I went over in 32 with a band, and I went over six times between 2003 and 2012. And I have never had so much love and appreciation and acceptance. And I've thought long and hard about this, you know, and I'm at this point, I was a 32-year-old person. My music career in Canada was done. You know, there was nothing for me in 2003. I put a record out in Europe and I had some good, strong connections. And we go over and open up for Sum 41 and play in front of 2,000 people a night. I've never seen so many happy people for my music ever. Still, I haven't seen, you know, to this day. The fact that there is somebody who appreciates, and I've talked about this on this show before, but I jokingly say, but I think there's some truth in there. They have art, they have culture, they've had spoken word longer than North Americans. They have a gene that I think can appreciate art and culture more. And the only example of that is there was a long time, I don't know what it's like now, but there was never any real, like, MTV, which was image-based music industry. It was like, it was like, we just want to hear your music, and we love your music. And Germans, I jokingly, they tell you exactly how they feel. There's no filter, you know? They'll tell you, hey, you look really fat and old, you know?
I don't mind honesty so much.
I know. For once, yeah, for once, yeah. And yeah, so are you planning on going over there more, just for the fact that it's people, you know, for the reason that you were saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a discussion, right? Why battle? Mm-hmm. You know, we know that we could do, I mean, people have been telling us, especially for the kind of stuff that we're playing, that it's really a perfect place for us to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that we could really build a great thing there. I mean, right now we're in the midst of some changes. So there's some business stuff, change in management,
mm-hmm.
Changing around the company, and some of those things are going on. So we're pushing that this year will be that change, you know, that we'll be able to get over there and really build something up there. So that we won't have to do the Battle of the States, but it'd be great to go down there too. You know?
Yeah. So, well, you can't isolate yourself from, you know, Americans, you know, you can't say that on this forum to say, hey, you know, fuck America, I'm not going there anymore. Can't say that. I can, because I'll probably never ever play there ever again. But to go there, I know it still costs money to get there. It still costs money to play there. But the reward is, it's maybe not monetary. The reward is from the respect and love from people that come and see your band.
And
you know, do you think that there's, everything goes in circles, right? Music always does the big circle for trends and things. Do you think we're getting back into 90s rock? Like, do you think there's this new upswing on, you know, is it time for that to happen again? Because I know, like, Rusty's back together, Treble Charger's back together, like, you know, Matt Good's playing tours and stuff.
Yeah, I just saw him. He came through Sarnia not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to see him. Great band. It's something that I pray for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It would be cool to just see the market swing back to, I mean, look at the 90s. There was still a lot of, there was variety in the top 10, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, what would be cooler than it to be like that, or, you know, like the 70s when you had, like, you know, you had Lynyrd Skynyrd, Zeppelin, Yes, mm-hmm. you know, all in the top 10 with Mark, you know, Dire Straits and like all this really cool stuff.
Yeah.
It would be great to see that again, to just get back to music.
Yeah.
Not all this so much image driven digital product, you know what I mean? It'd be cool to hear writing again in pop, right? You know what I mean? You can't say that that's everywhere because there's a lot of great stuff out there.
Yeah, I think music's morphing a lot now when it comes to people still don't know how to use today's technology to make a niche. We're still in its infancy stage, you know, like they've got it down, but then what it takes, like, a huge big change in that society to make better, you know, like, for instance, when, say, Nirvana broke, they broke all the rules. They were these guys who couldn't play. Well, they could play, but they weren't Guns N' Roses. They weren't, you know, Metallica. They were these dudes from, you know, that could kind of play music, and people loved it because they spoke to a generation.
Yeah.
We need that again. And because society is so fractured that, you know, my son listens to all sorts of, like, listens to pop radio, but he also knows who Green Day is. I don't think that existed 20 years ago. I think we liked the Beatles, but we also liked Slayer. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm talking up my ass. You know what I mean? You know, and you couldn't get two that are anywhere, you know, close together. But now it's so readily available. I mean, just Spotify alone, it boggles my mind on how instant your senses can be quenched because it's there.
I wonder if that can be just too much overload all the time. Like, there's just too much to choose from.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you make yourself that thing to be chosen? The you know, that's what people want to listen to is you. How do you do that when there's like 7 zillion, you know, there's access to so much stuff, you know?
There was a time, and I wasn't around for it, but when, like, say, Zeppelin came to Toronto, that was the most important thing to that city that night, you know? Led Zeppelin's coming to town.
Yeah.
And now, I bet you Led Zeppelin could come through and we're like, what? They played when? Like 2 days ago? What? You know? So, because, from what you're saying, there's too much overload. How do you filter that, you know, because there is a lot of noise out there, a lot of digital where everything's happening all the time. But I truly think in waves that when music turns into, you know, comes around again, that people will start not looking at their, I hope people won't be like checking their phones out every 2 minutes. There will be a movement. Like, remember there was this weird little movement where everybody went to the flip phone again. Like, I'm going archaic, I don't, you know, because it became consuming to them. It takes a big movement for people to say, you know, but then it's so goddamn convenient, you know, like, what's the score in the hockey game? Oh, I'll tell you exactly, you know.
Access to information. That's the kind of stuff, like, it drives you crazy at shows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've toured and did anything until I got back together with Ian and we did, you know, the Albatross record was done.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really been on the road in 10 years, you know,
mm-hmm.
and going back into audiences in the 2000 seat rooms or whatever, and everybody's watching the show through their cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing? You're missing the whole thing.
Yeah. And it's going to go on YouTube, and it was recorded with a really bad microphone through a really bad camera, and it's going to get on YouTube.
Yeah, you missed the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know?
But the other is a misrepresentation of your band, because they are going to put it on YouTube and they are going to show like this shaky footage of you way off in the distance. That does nothing.
A drunk guy yelling in the background.
That does nothing to anybody. I understand that, you know, that you need, as a music, you need content to show people to say, here we are, and this is our stuff, but that's bad. That's bad representation when it sounds bad and it looks bad and it is bad because of those two reasons. Might be the best show ever, but there's no feeling that from a live show that only a live show can capture, you know?
Yeah. I would like to see, you know, what you were talking about is for people to come around to that again.
Mm-hmm.
Go on and sit and just listen and pay attention to what they're seeing.
Yeah.
Not that constant distraction. Like, when you leave the house to go to the show tonight, leave the phone in your car. Leave the phone home for your own good.
Ah, your phone just went off.
Yeah, talk to the person next to you, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how about this? Here's an idea. You can actually check your phone with your coat. So you can have a free coat check, but leave your phone inside of it. And you can't videotape anything or anybody. It's your experience. And then when something special happens, people will talk about it, and then it'll become this myth and this legend that it'll perpetuate. But, you know, that's another thing we're missing, is that when Jim Morrison pulled his pants down, was there a video of it? Was there a guy putting it up on YouTube that night? You know what I mean? No, there was like 3,000 people or whatever that saw that, and then that became the story, you know, that made him famous.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if is that overexposure now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do people have too much access to you all the time that there's never curiosity? There's never, you know, there's no reasons. Like, I know everything, I've seen everything about you, and I'm just going to move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And there's no mystique or mystery, right, about you at all.
Yeah, well, Sia is doing that very, reinvented herself and brought all these great songs, in my opinion, but she covers her face. And this is a specific thing that she has her hair in front of her face so you can't see what she looks like. And her whole reason for what you're saying is to have a little bit of mystique and a little bit of intrigue and a little bit of this. Like, you know, when Kiss wore makeup, it's like, wow, that's really cool. I wonder who these people are, you know? So she
never gave it up.
No.
Until
Lick It Up.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a bad album. I didn't like that album at all. Anyway, I mean, I agree with you. We need a little bit of mystery, you know, and you know, but you know, at the same time, we have these things called podcasts, and podcasts is an interesting way that people can figure out who you are, you know, or they can listen to a conversation of, you know, of two middle-aged men prattle on about what it used to be like, and for some reason they find. Back in the old days when we had the no internets and, you know, but here we are, we're talking about that, and there are people out there who are 20 years younger than us that find that fascinating because they're not used, they don't know what it was like to be that because they were too young, you know. I work with people who are 20 years younger than me, you know. I was 20 years old and touring and they were babies. It's crazy.
Things have changed just a little bit. I remember I think Dave was like the first one. We got our first bus probably 98 or 99, so maybe 98. Could have been a little earlier. This crunchy old green smelly old thing. But it was,
I know that one.
Your first bus, man. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But I had one of those. I was the only guy, I think, who had a phone for a while. And it was my girlfriend, and it was one of those huge things that looked like, you know, you'd be like in World War II with the guy laying on the ground cranking it. And it was like $5,000 a second.
Yeah.
And then later it was Dave who I think was the first one, and probably Chuck. You probably know Chuck Ferguson, tour manager, sound guy.
Yes.
Yeah. He was our guy for years. And yeah, they were probably the first to like bring a computer on the bus and have internet and like fan stuff. And, you know, Dave Henning was sitting down you know, doing fan stuff on whatever that, I didn't even know what the hell it was, you know what I mean? We still just had that, I was still talking into this giant phone.
The first time I ever saw someone on a bus with a computer was Mark Crane. He brought a laptop, it was a Mac, and I think the only thing we'd play on it was Sims. I think that was the game we had, and it was like, wasn't even a color screen, it was grayscale. And this is like 97, 96, maybe? So, you know.
Yes.
It moved fast, huh? Like, you know, technology moved fast. From the mid-90s to 2005, we got a lot of cool stuff. Like,
yeah.
And it's still getting better. I mean, it still needs to be, like, when you're talking about computer-assisted recording, I would like to think that people are turning their music into a little bit more, making it more as real as possible, as opposed to trying to make it as fake as possible. Just the metal kids. The metal kids, they got to get together, because those kick drums, they don't work for me. You know what I mean? The perfect, you know, you're not fooling anybody.
It sounds like a machine. It doesn't sound real.
Yeah. But I think the music is changing and it's evolving. I would hope to think that people are now using computers just to capture it, because they are sick and tired of listening to share vocals and things like this.
Yeah. Yeah. Pitch correction and all that fun stuff. Right.
Yeah.
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 And you should be able to do your gig, I think, you know?
Yeah. And you being a trained musician, it must drive you even more nuts, because, you know, I took piano lessons and I took conservatory, but I also love the fact that I can fix a mistake in Pro Tools. I love that. but you...
No, I love it too. It's an excuse, but you got to be careful with it, right?
Yeah.
Like a doctor's not going to get away with that, you know? He's got to operate, he's got to cut the guy's chest open, he's got to do his gig, you know? There's not 9 million doctors that just, you know...
No, that's true.
Actually got to do a
huge
job.
We'll fix it later. We'll fix it later. You know, we did some damage, but I think we can fix it later. You know, moving on.
Yeah, we left the fork in there. Don't worry.
I was trying to start this website where people did this, and it seems like Skype won, you know, when it came to, because what we're doing, this conversation through this video link is it's embedded into the website, so you can actually use this method rather than using Skype. So you don't need to give your personal information to anybody, you know, we just connect. But teaching over Skype, it just must be a really cool thing, because nobody's in your house, you know, like, you know, people can be on the other side of the world and want to teach or want to learn from you. And that must feel pretty cool too.
Yeah, well, this is where technology is really cool. Like, I love the idea of this, of what you're doing. I think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
The podcaster just, you know, talk with artists, and you have experience in the business too. Like, you've been there, so it's cool. And you can listen to a lot of cool stuff from a fan perspective, and even from, you know, musicians or touring guys like ourselves. Or, you know, this is a great thing to listen to. I think it's cool.
Well, yeah. Thanks.
The Skype thing, for me, when I heard about it, it was more about when we have downtime, being able to, like, I still have students come to my apartment, but when I go on the road, a lot of those people you'll lose, right? Because you're gonna say you gotta go on the road for 2 months or 3 months, you know, you lose the consistency with them, and it's no good for them either, right? They need consistency, especially the younger guys.
Mm-hmm.
But this I can do. This I can keep them all. Like, if I'm, you know, I can be backstage before a show or wherever and teach, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's cool, and it's great for fans to get involved too. You know, and learn learn directly from the artist as well. It's pretty cool. You know, I think it's a pretty cool deal. So that keeps me busy.
Yeah.
During our off time, it. You know, I've got to dig back into my theory and make sure I'm working on my chops, and, you know, I've got to make sure I've got all that stuff together, and that's really good for me too. So it's good all the way around. I like it.
Is there an age group and an age or skill set category where it works better than others? Say, like, someone who can kind of all play already, or is it good for all skill sets from beginner to...
I, I think the Skype thing, I think, is better for like intermediates and up. It's difficult to do with beginners. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't recommend it too much with beginners. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you need a little more hands-on, a little more guidance with just holding the instrument. It gets a little weird if the camera's not right. And,
yeah.
You know, they have to mess around. And you need to just focus just on getting them situated with the instrument, you know what I mean? And getting their hands to just make a sound, you know what I mean? So I wouldn't really do it so much at the beginning.
And just literally moving a hand 2 frets to the left is easier than saying 2 frets to the left. No, not my left, your left.
Yeah. And you're spinning the whole, So, but yeah, up from beginner, you know, it's worked out really well. Everybody I've been doing this with, has been coming back consistently, and they like it a lot, so it's been good.
And you can switch your notifications off and everything, right? Because what drove me nuts with using Skype, and the only reason I came to this technology, was that whenever someone came on Skype, you hear blah, 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 you know, you hear that, like, that notification. And I don't know if you could switch it off, but when I was using it, there was this time when Skype was amazing. And it was amazing before Microsoft got its gritty little fingers in there. It was, I don't know what happened. I think they tried to make it too snappy or too good, and for that everybody suffered. But it seems I haven't used Skype in a long time, but it must be better now.
I don't know. You know, I couldn't compare it because I really didn't get into it probably about a year and a half ago is when I started doing this, when we got off the road.
Yeah, because Skype's been around
again. I might be able to compare it.
Yes.
I find it's fast as long as both people, you have good, I have a good connection. The problem, it's in time, it's clear, and good. I wouldn't, like I said, I couldn't compare.
Yeah, because Skype's been around for almost 10 years. Well, it's been around since 2008 that I remember. And when I first joined up on it, it was like they gave you 50 euros of credit. And I joined up, and when I went to Europe, I used pretty much like 20 euros of credit on it. And so I had it all the way from, you know, for almost 2 years without using any credit. And it was amazing. I saved so much money with it. And at that time, Wi-Fi wasn't locked down as much as it is now. So you just walk through somebody's, like, to their front of their house, and you would catch a Wi-Fi signal. And then I would sit on their front yard and call my wife and call home with my iPhone with the SIM card taken out. And it was amazing. Like it changed how people communicate. And now, like, Google's on board. Google has a telephone function where you can actually call phones, and it's free in North America. And I don't think I think there's other things, but this technology is called WebRTC, and it basically embeds the video and audio. And say if I type in Brian 123 and you type in Brian 123, we connect. And to me, I think that's pretty strong stuff. That's pretty powerful stuff. Like that on this great big world that I can connect to you just by typing the same letter or the same, you know, phrase. Then it's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, this works really well. I've never used it before, but I know what you're saying about Skype. I know that you can. I'm not going on the talk. Just left my brain. Long day of theory, so I've. Never mind. Next thing.
Yeah. I got a long day too. I mean, I'm so busy these days. And tomorrow, the venue I work at, we're doing Gowan. Gowan's coming to our venue.
Where are you now?
I work at the Richmond Hill Center for the Performing Arts,
cool. Just
north of Toronto. And I was at York University for 10 years, doing sound there. And I just got this job in Richmond Hill, and it's been super rewarding and super fun. And like, we have like Gowan's coming through, Kim Mitchell's coming through, they do a lot of presents, Stephen Wright, the comedian's coming through, so
awesome.
Yeah,
awesome. He's one of my favorites.
He's awesome. Yeah, I can't wait.
I love
for
him.
That
he's insane. I love him.
So
very cool.
Yeah, so what's up with the Big Rack? You're still playing, but what's in the future? What's going on?
Like I said before, like new business stuff, so there's been some changes there.
Yeah.
And we're looking at going and doing a new record, mm-hmm. we were talking about, you were just, before we were talking about trying to do some things old school and stay away from a lot of technology. And I think we're going to try and take that, we'd like to try and take that approach on this one. So we'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do more of a live kind of thing.
Yeah. Because you can just record right off the floor and things sound phenomenal. You could, maybe you couldn't do that 20 years ago unless there was some sacrifices to be made. Ron Hawkins of the Rusty Nails and the Do-Goods and Lowest of the Low, he did a live off the floor album, and it sounded like a real production to me. Like it sounded like a real record, you know. He's like, "No, we just practiced, played live off the floor." He said, "We played it 100 times, but it's still live." You know what I mean? That's where we need to go.
Yeah, I think so. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's our mix of modern technology and old school, right? When we combine them both, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we should be going in soon to do some pre-pro and jamming and writing and blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, we'll have something finished by the end of the summer. We got some on. We're actually going to be up in Richmond Hill for the Cosmos. I guess we're playing one of the shows there. Headline.
Oh, they're a sponsor of ours. So you'll meet. When is that? When is that happening?
June?
I think it is. I think you're right. I'll fact check it because Cosmo Music is our main sponsor, and I thought they were just like a Long & McQuaid style store, but you know, this is a spot for them. They're pretty impressive things. Like their backline company alone. The part of their backline is the most pro-looking, well-maintained backline because we rent backline off of them to do our shows. Great stuff,
oh, yeah?
Man.
Cool.
It's awesome. It's wow. Maintained, and they're very cool. Yeah. Cosmo Music, everybody.
Yeah, so we'll be up. We're going to do that. We've got a couple shows in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
That Niagara Fit. There's only like 4 shows right now on the bill, so we've got some scattered festival stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, we'll just be working on a record and
mm-hmm.
hopefully be on the road by fall, but you know how it goes, right?
Yeah.
Your hopes are to get it done and get out on the road and get to work and go play, right? But it doesn't work that way.
What's the direction? Can you talk about where it's going and like direction wise, like are you revisiting older influences or?
I think the influence is pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, at this point, there's just too much material, I think, to really say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've bounced some stuff back and forth with Ian. Ian's got, you know, millions of things as usual that are all really cool.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's kind of broad. You know what I mean? It's hard to say. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's going to be what it is. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say. You can say right now, okay, we want the record to sound like this. And, you know, you get into the studio or you start writing and jamming with everybody and things can change, right? So what you think you're going to do 6 months down the road is totally different. So.
Well, that's the joy of making a record with a bunch of people that you know, that you can trust them to put ideas into it and make it better, or you can have a conversation and say, I don't like that, and this is why. And you know, that a lot of people, that's what we need to revisit, is like the making of an album, like, I don't know, like what Wilco did with Yankee Foxtrot, you know, and they just wrote this album and it became their one of their biggest albums. But at the same time, there was a lot of deconstruction and there was a lot of thoughts and a lot of arguments, but the product's amazing, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's really cool.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we all share the same influences. We all listen to the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it's 70s blues rock and blues. And
sure.
You know what I mean?
So, yeah. What's your favorite Pink Floyd album?
As of late, Animals.
I have always been an Animals fan. I listen to Dogs religiously every day for 30 days on a tour. Every day. I couldn't, it put me to sleep. It was great. That album is a special album. I think everybody should.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that album.
I think it's missed. I think it's missed. It's mm-hmm. it's really simple. There's not a huge production on it, but it sounds great. It's just keys, guitar, bass, drums, and it's not like what they got into on the Wall, and there's not a lot of instrumentation. But it's great.
I listened to the drumming, and as simple as that record is on drums, I think, how can he play? Because he's playing for 22 minutes. There obviously is some hard edits, and got to be some tape edits in there, but it's the same drum sound from the top of that song to the end. And even when it gets into the weird synthy weird stuff, he's still playing Ride. You know, he's still keeping time. And
Still there.
Yeah. And it was his studio. Yeah, he bought the studio to basically record that album in. And I think The Wall became their, obviously, their swan song and their most popular album. But Animals, man, you wouldn't have, if you didn't have Animals, you wouldn't have had The Wall. Because Animals sort of was big for them too, but they had had enough, you know, I could talk Pink Floyd all night. I love Pink Floyd. You know, I listen to a lot of music, but Pink Floyd is one of those albums that I can just put, I'll probably listen to it tonight. I have it on my phone. You know, I'm glad.
You know what it reminds me of? I love going back and listening to that stuff, and I still have the LP too, but it always reminds me of the days when you couldn't wait to get out of school so that you could run to the record store and put all the change you had scratched up out of your pockets onto the counter and buy a copy of it. And when you got a copy of a record back then, it was an event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a listening event. You ran home and you sat down and you sat in front of your stereo and you listened to it over again. And your attention, there was nothing that could draw your attention away from it. You're so focused and just savoring every note and everything. You know?
Yeah.
Reading all the liner notes and, you know, everything. You know, that's one of those records to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's not only just about the content, the musical content and everything on it, but it's the memories of those things. You know, you don't do that so much anymore, you know?
No, I agree with you. I agree. I had a conversation with a guy, Kale Madsen, and he was talking about vinyl and how special it was to him. He's like, he's probably 23, 24. But my only counter to that was, when I'm walking in the woods and I have my iPod and I'm listening to a song, I feel the music sometimes more when I'm in the woods walking. And that's one part I think it's the same feeling, but the exact opposite. That when I came home, when I cracked open Hemispheres by Rush and I put it on the turntable and I go, this is the best thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, this changed my life. That record I learned to play bass to. So when I sit and listen to that album now, I go back to the exact living room that I listened to it in, and I hold it in such high regard, as well as Animals. And Animals, we had this little boat and we'd go up through these little canals and stuff. And that was a big record at the time. And that takes me to that time when I was listening to it there. So everything's so geographical, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Your environment, right?
Actually. Yeah. Yeah. Makes it feel better, you know? And I listened to Animals on a tour bus for 30 days in a row. And I don't know why I did it. I just did, and it put me to sleep and it made me feel better.
Yeah, great. What a great record.
Even it's super depressing, too. It's so depressing that you listen to it. It's like so skeptical and but it's my favorite album.
I don't think Waters has really written anything different than that.
No.
He doesn't seem like a particularly happy kind of guy, but
no.
It's great. Great stuff.
I'm afraid if I meet Roger Waters, I will hate Pink Floyd, because when I see him in interviews, I try not to listen to it because I think he's a bit of a dick. I think.
You know, I got to this point a long time ago where there's some artists, you know, actors as well as musicians that I have this image of them, and I'm sure part of it's imagined. You know, it's what I make them up to be, or, you know, what I really would like them to be, you know, my hero.
Mm-hmm.
But I've learned to just, as soon as I hear them speak, just close my ears and run away. Because I don't want to be let down, you know?
Yeah.
Especially, like, you know, you get closer, you get bigger in the business, and you make more connections with bigger people. And you go into studios and you start to hear, you know, the war stories about the road or what this guy's like and what this guy is like. And some of it can be, you know, oh no, he's not like that. No way. He's just totally ruined my, crushed my image of him.
Yeah.
I can't listen to him.
Yeah. Well, you know, I work with bands and now it turns into, I stick with them because I like them. And that's what makes me still do this, is that I like the people I work with. And I don't necessarily need to like the music. I just like them as people, which involve actually makes me like their music. Does that make sense? I could be coming into a new gig with a band I don't know, and they're just such cool people that I can open up my taste to say, oh, I like your band, and I don't know why I like your band. I just like you as a person. That's going to make me like you, your music. I don't know if that's judgmental or weird, but
I get it. I mean, if there's one thing, if you're not inside that situation, I think you're outside, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not something you can really explain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing quite like being on the road with, you know, for 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or whatever with a group of people all doing the same thing in and out every night and sharing, you know, sharing music and working really hard and traveling and experiencing mm-hmm. and I think we're really, really, really fortunate to do that, to be able to experience that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been really lucky. Like over the last couple of years, well, since the Albatross record, we've had just some great crew guys and tour managers and lighting guys. And, you know, if we're, everybody's hanging out together, band and crew, and everybody's together hanging out, you know, we sit down, we eat dinner together, we work together. That's really cool, you know.
It's
really,
like
I'm really, really fortunate. You know, we got to remember, we got to be grateful for that stuff. It's really cool.
It's like a cool little club, you know. You're a little band of pirates that sort of get in a vehicle and take off. There's still that mystique of touring and having your club, you know. And you know, same with me. Like when I'd get in a van as a musician. And we'd be playing with other bands. It felt so much closer to the other bands, and everybody felt closer because you were seeing the same people every day, you know, for days on end. And it felt like when they left, you're like, "Oh, that bums me out." You know, I wish we could do this forever.
Yeah. Going home. It's like that. There's another thing people understand. It's like you know, you're out for a while and you want to go home, and then you're home for like a week and you're just dying to get back, right?
Yeah. Get back to camp.
You just get so close to people. You know?
Yeah.
It's a drug, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that you actually you when because I like I said you appreciate music. You can tell that there's music and the experience is as important as say all the success and dollars and cars and things and. And you still love music because you teach people. And that's another thing that, you know, I think that's a good tell, you know, like, you know, so you're still doing it. And do you think though, if you had a choice to do something else in this, I've never asked this question, but if you had a chance to do something other than music or, you know, what, do you have anything like I could have done something else? You know, you obviously, I think I know the answer, but sell hats or something.
I don't know. It's tough to say. I mean, the first thing I think of is just trades. Like I did a lot of carpentry work. I framed for a living. I did that kind of stuff. I love carpentry.
Mm-hmm.
I love it for the rewarding and every day is different and you're always learning.
Yeah.
You know, I love that kind of thing. And I still do it. Like I do it for a hobby. And,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Nothing's coming to mind at the moment. I don't know what else I'd do.
Well, it's funny you'd say like carpentry, like Finnish carpentry and stuff. Like that's an art. That's a trade. That's a talent.
Yeah.
Some people are better than others at. Like I can't do trim. I don't understand. You know what I mean? But I think that coincides with art because you want to be better. You understand the growth that you start here with this knowledge, and then you learn something, and then you become better. And in a nutshell. That's what playing the guitar is, right? You know, you figure something out, and you usually do it either through research or you do it through mistake, and then you figure, oh, okay, I know what to do now. So, you know, that's cool because that's sort of what you just said. It sort of coincides with carpentry. Well,
yeah. What did you think? What did you think I was going
to
say?
I don't know, like. Because I talk to people who say, like, if I only studied harder in school, maybe I'd be a lawyer or so. You know what I mean? Like, I have people that, a lot of them don't mean it. You know what I mean? But I you know, there's a, problem with music and playing it for a long time is sometimes people get a little bit judgmental about things, and I don't hear it in you. I hear a lot of positivity, and I like that. But I hear good positive energy, and I hear good vibes and all that stuff. But I talk to some people who feel that the music owes them something, or the music they gave should be more successful. And I disagree with that. I think if just being able to play music in front of people is enough, my opinion. And you, if you like to play music, like some people love to play hockey, but they're not going to be a professional hockey player by a long shot, right? So you got to figure out, why do I play hockey? Well, I love playing hockey. Okay, well, there you go. That's your answer. You don't need to make $1 million playing hockey. You just go play hockey.
Yeah, if that's your motivation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if it's honest, mm-hmm. for real, then you should do it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Who cares? If money's your motivation, then you're in trouble.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, hey, man, I appreciate you coming on the show. And whenever you want to come back, this is fun, And I find that I could talk for 3 hours with someone like you, but I feel that it's like, first of all, we both have other things to do in the morning. And the other thing is that I think we could do a chapter two in a year from now, and the fact that, if you ever want to come on the show again, please let me know, and we'll...
Yeah, anytime. It was a blast. It was cool. I really like this. It's very cool and comfortable. For real.
Thanks, man. Well, yeah, I'll hit stop now.